Hey, RP. My name's Tom Scott, chairman of the Nantucket Project. I'm with RP Eddy. Runs Ergo Intelligence background. You guys know the deal. Thanks for being here, RP. Before we came on, we were talking about sort of the swirling conversation about to what degree are we going to be like Sweden, right? A lot of Sweden talk. Everyone talks about Sweden now, which seems to make sense. And one of the things we were highlighting was the fact that it seems to be a matter of degrees now. Like my general reaction is that left and right, it's all about some degree of reemergence. And it's just then it comes down again to this question of a matter of degrees. One of the things that's happened is this, there's a bit of a dispute and a debate around these two doctors in Southern California. And I'm a lay person here, but my own simple maths suggested that they were wrong in some of the data that they were using, and YouTube took them down and Facebook kept them up. That in and of itself, I don't think is such a big deal, but you do get a sense that the facts versus fiction debate tied into this, to what degree of Sweden are we going to be, has made for a complicated moment. Do you agree? How do you react to that?
I think your introduction is a great explanation of how complicated the situation is right now, right? This has always been a complicated situation for us because it's brand new stuff. We all have to understand virology all of a sudden. We have to understand epidemiology. We have to understand federal versus state jurisdictions. There's a lot of stuff everybody has to learn here. Epidemiologists have to learn government. Governments have to learn virology. Economists have to learn all these things. And none of us did this all before. There's very few people have this matrix set of expertise. In fact, maybe none.
Right.
So we're all learning a lot quickly. And put that in the backdrop of, we're still learning critical aspects about the virus. There's not one book on the virus with all the answers. We don't know even all the stuff we have to know about the virus. So we can run off in all sorts of directions about, are we Sweden? Are we South Korea? What's going on? I mean, the list goes on and on. Let me try to give a little bit of clarity about one thing. What America has to do, and then let's say before August 15th, August 18th, end of August, is already established. What we're going to do is already established. We're going to open up state by state, region by region. Some will go faster than others. Some will be effectively, in my point of view, more careful than others as far as the state leadership. And we're going to get more and more people back to work, back to the factories, back to school. We talked about how critical school is, and that's going to happen. I don't care what other question we need to know, that's what's going to happen. And basically, there are no questions right now to which we're waiting for answers that are going to change that reality. We're getting back to work. As we get back to work, we then begin to address a question that every single one of us has to answer at every moment. It becomes this very multivariate equation about, when RP Eddy walks outside, how carefully do I do that? When I walk to the office, how careful am I doing that? And as each of us are making those decisions, we then create our collective destiny for this virus. Do I wear a mask? Do I wash my hands? Do I have to get on public transport? Do I have to work at a meat factory next to other people? Are my bosses making it safe? Can they afford to make it safe? These things all will happen on a one-to-one basis, and the disease will respond unemotionally, precisely, to what we give it as growth fodder. That's going to happen.
Yeah.
Here's what we don't know. As we create this 330 million person vector of decisions, which is what happens when we all get rolling again, where does the virus take advantage of our mistakes? And not just mistakes, the realities of what we have to do. Are we going to have big outbreaks in small cities? Are we going to have big outbreaks in big cities? What's the future going to look like from the virus's point of view? My presumption right now, so now I'm going from fact to question to presumption. My presumption right now is that we're going to have a series of outbreaks in smaller cities. New York probably got religion on this. Seattle, San Francisco already have. They're showing more responsible behaviors. Other cities, the Green Bay, Wisconsin's, the Lincoln, Nebraska's, et cetera, may have spikes. So might the big cities. I'm talking in the next month or two. Here's my presumption on top of a presumption. You can see how this becomes very tenuous. The healthcare systems in those cities will be able to handle that surge without being lethally overwhelmed. It will be a crisis. Healthcare workers will get sick. They will still not have enough PPE. We still will not have enough testing to do it right. But it still won't be Lombardy, France, where we have to decide who gets the ventilator and who doesn't. And we'll get back to school and we'll get back to work. And then we can keep going, right? But let's not extend the logic tree too far, the decision tree too far, because then it gets very specious. So there's that.
Sweden gets a lot of play. You know, everyone's going to compare it somehow to Sweden. One of the things that I like what I've heard in a variety of places is that there are no win-wins here, and you're going to have to choose which losses you're going to be prepared to take. And what do you think is the most? I mean, look, the general theory of Sweden I think is generally understood. What are the specific things you know that Sweden have taught us that is most valuable? Are there valuable things that Sweden has taught us?
Let's just start with the decision-making matrix that any responsible leader should take when they look at this disease. And that matrix, that how to make decisions about this disease, has become more clear over time. Just a reminder, it's the first plague the world's gone through since 1917, right? And there's no playbook. The world's too different. Sweden, you name a country, almost every leader in the world, with one notable exception, I think, is probably really trying to do the math based on overall saving lives, right? So you have to have one flag you fly, one direction you aim. A good one is let's save as many lives as possible. Now, saving lives over what period of time becomes the big question. Is it save lives this week, this month, this year, or over 3 years? Why'd I pick 3 years? At some point we'll have a vaccine. Let's keep our fingers crossed and hope it's within 18 months. Let's presume that for now. That's an optimistic presumption. And let's then look at the decisions you have to make up to that point. The Swedish decision says, hey, guys, there's a lot of death, a lot of cost to shutting down economies. When everyone stays home, you end up with 1 mile long bread lines in America's Midwest. We have that right now. When the economy stops, when 30 million people are unemployed in America, 10% of the entire population, up to 25 to 30% of the workforce, whatever that number is, you know, you pay a huge cost. We have to work to live. People will die if they're not out and about working, buying, going to the doctor. There's a series of deaths that happen that are corona-related deaths that aren't from the disease. Not going to your doctor for preventative health care, finding out you have cancer later. That's a death. Staying at home too afraid to go to the hospital while you have a stroke because you're afraid of corona in the hospital, that's a death. Deaths of despair from addiction and suicide and other things, that's a death. Children being destroyed one way or the other because they're at home with abusive parents, that's a death or a huge cost. Those are real things. It's very short-sighted, very simple just to say, ooh, we got to save every life we can right now from just the disease and ignore other future consequences. So any good decision maker, and all of us have to be those decision makers, should use the metric, so far as I'm concerned, about lives saved, let's call it a 3-year period. Sweden did the math. They said, because we have a really strong social safety net, really good hospital system, really high conformity, our people behave, we tell them what to do, they do it, and a really high education basis, and we're largely homogenous, meaning we kind of get along well. There's not a lot of people standing on courthouse steps holding machine guns and yelling. Let's try to trust everybody to behave themselves. We talked before about the experiment of 330 million people going out and seeing how safe we can be. Sweden made the decision that they could do that better than others have. So they said, let's protect the vulnerable, which ended up being an error. They didn't protect them enough. And everybody else, be smart, get on your life. Hospitals open, restaurants open, bars are open, etc. Did I say hospitals? Hospitals, obviously. Hotels are open. So off they go. And so on the upside, their unemployment has barely increased, right? Because they're all working. On the upside, Alcoholism is not increased. Deaths of despair are not going to increase. People are still going to the doctor. All those things I mentioned are, they're going to be in the good on that, right? For that calculus, the weight of the corona-related deaths, they're going to do great. The corona deaths, they're doing currently in this time frame poorly. They have a higher per capita death rate from this disease than most countries. Not all, most. And certainly higher than it would be if they had done a lockdown. They have great healthcare, as I said. Now, part of that is because they are human. They're not superhuman, and they had a big mistake with their elderly care, their old folks' homes. They had a bunch of people getting sick there and dying, so that made their numbers even worse. Now, the Swedish bet, first of all, it's not dramatically different than where we really are. It's dramatically different than China, which literally locked you down at gunpoint. India moved millions of migrant workers by force around the country. America's been largely voluntary too, except for businesses. So they're different, but not like shockingly. So their outcome, their decision makers believe, hey, we think when you weigh that, the actual deaths from the disease in the next 3 years or 18 months, and then the deaths that are related to the cure of the disease, as I described before, they think that they will win, that their numbers will be better. The jury is still out. I think if you're Sweden, that wasn't a bad call. And as you said the other day, Tom, it was courageous in a way. It was, and courageous is a weird word, but let's say it was bold, right? And by the way, in Sweden right now, the body politic is very supportive of what they're doing. So that's the Sweden story. And within it, you can kind of see the decisions that really smart, competent leaders ought to be making, recognizing this fog of war concept that we don't really know the answers to all these questions. We don't know basic biology of the disease, let alone, you know, we're trying to model out multivariate equations that are we're learning in real time. So for Sweden, my bet was probably the right decision. It seems a little brutal right now. They're going to lose 20,000 people by the end of August is my unfortunate guess. I think that's the number we came up with. I think they'll have 20,000 deaths by the end of August out of a country of 10 million. That's pretty high. Very sad. 20 million people who wouldn't have died so quickly.
20,000.
Go ahead.
You said 20 million. You meant 20,000.
Thank you. 20,000. But the bet is that they will not lose 21,000 lives during this period of time because of some of the other concomitant costs that come from the shutdowns.
Yeah. Can I read you, RP, a piece of the note that we're sending to the guy who runs the camp? And I'm just curious how you react to it.
Yeah.
If you find it helpful. To me, I the reason I keep bringing this up is it is its own version of a microcosm of what's happening right now. And to be clear, it is a luxury to consider whether or not our children go to camp. I know that's true. On the other hand, it is the kinds of decisions that as a culture we're going to need to make because it is about education, it's about the economy, it's about a variety of things. And so we just want to be smart as parents. But just briefly, you know, we're writing you in this difficult time to provide emotional and perhaps tactical support as you consider your next steps. I'm jumping ahead. You know, as we understand in your letter dated today, he sent us a letter yesterday, you are weighing the pros and cons for opening the business in the summer of 2020. Our point of view is fairly straightforward. We would like to enter an exploration aimed at supporting opening camp for the summer. Clearly, you have many decisions tied to safety questions, regulatory questions, and liability questions, to name just a few. We recognize that none of this is straightforward. Nonetheless, while it may be difficult, we can imagine there may be a scenario under which you open the camp with safe protocols and policies in place. And at a minimum, we would like to team with you to attempt to address these challenges. We go on to say we fully recognize the answer may be no, and that might be the smart answer, but that's sort of the nature of the letter. I got to believe a lot of people are going through processes like this.
Here's something to keep in mind, right? Human thinking always bleeds from one topic to the next, and we take one frame and then we put it on another frame and think it's the proper frame. Let me suggest that, just to be explicit, the frame about decision makers in Sweden or the US or other places and what kind of risks they're willing to take and how they take them isn't the frame that we have to make on our individual bases, okay? So the unit of measurement for a government policymaker, I think, ought to be number of people who die. Right? It's measurable at the end. It's strong. We get it. Kind of inarguable.
over some given period.
It has to be over a period of time. Now, footnote, and this is worth another conversation. There are people, good friends of mine, who are saying, as we said the other day, we're fetishizing death. I won't have that conversation now. But let's just say number of people dead is a great measure of success. Number of people saved being the flip side. When you talk about, when I talk about what I do with my family this summer, where my kids go, death shouldn't be part of the measure, right? Anything that's going to risk death should probably be taken off the table, because I'm not going to incur any real death cost by doing it, right? Meaning if we have a lockdown in the Yeti house and my kids don't go to camp, we're not going to incur not going to the doctor, dying of cancer, dying of death of despair, et cetera, those other things. So the risk from those exposures have to be considered, understanding that there's way lower to no relative reward by having the exposure. Meaning, if we're only measuring by death, we're not saving lives by going to camp. Now we're improving lives, but we're not saving lives. So just keep that in mind. Now, so then you have the question of, all right, sure, what you're effectively saying is make sure no one dies at camp or because of camp. I get it. So let's look at the numbers. There's this horror about knowing you're sending anybody you love into a scenario where there's any chance of death, right? Now, we sent our kids to camp for hundreds of years knowing they could get the flu. Some kids probably unfortunately went to camp and got the flu or got diphtheria or got something that was sort of out there. And some, God, those children, God rest their souls, died. It happened. But it wasn't as obvious to us that it was out there. It should be obvious to everyone now that when you send your kid to camp, using that as a scenario, and it can be the same scenario as, let's use children in activities. When you send a child to an activity right now, you are putting them into a pool where there is a virus swimming that does have some chance of, a very small chance, but a chance nonetheless of killing children. It's got a way higher chance of killing older people. So there is this psychic pain for the one parent who's going to send their child to some summer activity and that child is going to get sick and maybe even die. Like, that will happen. And they'll say, holy shit, how can this be? The statistics say that it's this tiny, tiny percentage of children who will die from this disease. And the answer will be, yes, it's true. That is the percentage. You got the very, very unlucky, horrible straw here. So that's part one, even though it's less than other diseases, right? Part two is, all right, so we understand the kids. Now let's understand, what do we do with those kids when they're done, right? I am unfortunately concerned about my health given some comorbidities I have if I'm exposed to the virus. I am very concerned about my parents as you are about yours, our dads. So that's a decision. So go off to camp, go to that event, participate in that thing, child. But we now presume they're infected and they're going to carry the virus back. So those are just the two things we have to solve for. The first one, again, just recapping it, trying to be a little more pithy. It's knowing you're putting your child into a firing line, no matter how small the percentage chances are, is horrible compared to like this nebulous view we had about disease before. You know, we knew it was out there. We knew it happened once in a while, and it did. But now we actually know there's a disease with a name out there that we're putting our kids at risk for, even if statistically it's extremely small. I mention all that because it's also going to influence human behaviors that influence the economy.
The interesting thing I'll tell you is that, and some of this is perception, but some of this I know to be the case, is that, again, because I'm in conversations with several of the parents now, they span the spectrum politically, and they all have these same curiosities and hopes, which is hopeful to me, is that generally speaking, I think people are unified in their desire to create solutions and their willingness to step into risk, because what we're doing. We're stepping into a risky territory. Anyway, and then the other thing I just want to point out, and we didn't even talk about it in this context, I find my optimism in part based on my optimism that come August 6th, when camp's over, Walt and Hank are on their way home, we do the test. How are we doing, guys? Oh, you're looking good. Good, we can go home now. I'm assuming that in that formula. I mean,
that's a great point, Tom, right? So thank you. Everything I just said, the child risk is the same. It will be reduced. We'll be smarter. But look, kids are going to get it. There's no way I'm sending a child under this age of 22 into a group and expecting that they're going to not, that they'll be able to keep social distancing, wear the mask, wash their hands, particularly a summer camp. Ain't going to happen. Becomes a petri dish, they're all going to get it, right? And so then you have that small statistical chance that they're going to get very sick. But you're right. If we can then test them, you know, maybe a really good camp on the way out tests every kid as they leave, get in your car, and then, you know, ideally you find out quickly. Probably takes a day. So, you know, maybe have to sit around for a day, right?
And you know, and you know, these are again, I'm using this as a microcosm. If anyone thinks, yes, I have a selfish interest in my kids go to camp, which I think is a loving selfish interest. But I also just think of it as a placeholder to so many other things. And from a timing perspective, you're talking about June 26th. So you're talking about 7 weeks from now. 7 weeks from now, am I going to go back to my office? 7 weeks from now, am I going to make a go, no go on some of my work events? 7 weeks from now, on and on, am I going to go to dinner? Am I going to lunch? There's just so many things I want to start thinking about. And if nothing else, I want to be part of the solution, both tactically and emotionally. And so I'm going to have to start dipping my toe in the water a little bit. And I think we're all going to have to start dipping our toes in the water a little bit. And 30 million people out of work is a huge deal. It's a huge deal.
Sure is.
And it'll get worse over time. And you know, numbers, earnings reporting, things like that as we go forward are going to get, you know, kind of scary. Anyway, so RP, controversy around these two doctors in Southern California who, as I best understand it, are both MDs, but they're also entrepreneurs who operate a chain of walk-in medical clinics in Southern California. A lot of people have watched what they've been talking about, and they were removed from YouTube and they're still on Facebook. My general impression, and this is very layperson, I'm saying that in advance, that's why I'm asking the question. I'm interested in how you view this. I'm going to use one statistic that I found erroneous. There may be others. The one that I saw is they used a number where they said in New York, they listed the number of deaths, which I don't recall exactly what it was, but they then extrapolated that to a statewide infection projection, which I'm going to assume is erroneous because most of the people who got tested to date in New York are people showing symptoms. So that if you then project it across the total number of people in the state and you measure the number of deaths and you use that as the, you know, the likelihood of death number, you're off. There's a bunch of other stuff they say that seems to be off. And do you know much about this story?
Yeah.
And I'd be curious to your comment on how accurate or inaccurate you think some of the statements they made are. That's the first part. And then the second part is, you know, to me, it brings up the question of, and I don't know where I stand on this because I'm just being honest. Is it Facebook's job to edit these kinds of things out? And under what conditions do they make these kinds of decisions? Which then you can consider that same question more broadly in a whole variety of ways. But the result is that we've got this place of controversy. They are, I guess there's images of them supporting Donald Trump, these two guys, which, you know, it's neither here nor there, as long as they're sort of sharing what I would hope would be accurate information. But you can imagine where this one goes. I'm curious how you're reacting to this story.
All right, let's try to do it in a really clear framework, right? Let's look at past, present, future biases, and then this question about social media. So what do we actually know about this disease that doesn't require us to have to use a number, right? That's totally inarguable. We already know that China had to shut down a third of its economy to combat a disease that was ripping through its country, killing thousands and thousands of people. Like, that happened, it's a fact, okay? We know that Lombardy, Italy, so they're Chinese, it's far away, it's a little different. Make it more real to me. Okay, Lombardy, Italy, with a healthcare system apparently better than America's, had people dying in hospital hallways, hospital parking lots, doctors getting infected, and a death rate that's astounding. And like thousands and thousands of people dying out of the blue from this disease. Okay, that's new. We know that. A little bit better, but still horrible in Seattle, New York, New Orleans. Like, we know these things happened. Unfortunately, because of HIPAA, the health privacy laws, and because of just the rules of hospitals, which are ones you'd want them to follow if you're in the hospital, journalists are not roaming the halls of hospitals taking pictures of dying people. They don't want to be there themselves. They don't want to get sick. It's an area we don't see as much of. I mean, we literally have reporters on the battlefields in Somalia, Iran, and Iraq, but we don't have them inside hospitals for the reasons I just described. So it's a little blind to us. But it happened. We know it happened. There's no argument. And we also know from reality after reality, Lakanthus disease, is it doesn't take a vacation, right? I mean, you give this disease a chance to grow, it grows, it spreads. So those are facts, we know them. All right, now, biases. So if you look at our book, Warnings, we have something called the Cassandra Coefficient, where we talk about why people ignore warnings. So let's say these two doctors fall on the side of doubters who are ignoring these warnings. Why are they ignoring these warnings? Two that come to mind are, one is self-interest. So do they have a self-interest to ignore the warning? So there's a warning out there. Duh, we're living in it. Do these two doctors have a self-interest to ignore the warning? I don't want to impugn them, but I would suggest that they own businesses that rely on walk-in healthcare, right? Now, what did we say earlier about people going to doctors? People going to doctors that aren't sick from corona are going down dramatically. People, to the point where people are dying at home from strokes because they're afraid of going to the hospital. So the flow of people to hospitals and doctor's offices is down dramatically. What if you own a bunch of doctor's offices? How's your business? It's down dramatically. So they have some self-interest here. I don't know if that consciously or subconsciously or at all influences their point of view, but note they're self-interested actors, part one. Two, they are MDs. Does that mean that they are true experts on this topic? It does not. There are all sorts of MDs of various qualities. They're not epidemiologists. They're not virologists. They're not even infectious disease doctors. So while I completely respect their medical background, I'd rather listen to a Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ian Lipkin or Rear Admiral Ken Bernard or Dr. Fauci, who are folks who have multiple decades of experience and degrees in the question at hand, not in the type of medicine in which they're expert. They do have certainly some expertise by virtue of their four-year MD, but they are not experts on these topics. So non-experts also are a problem inside the decision-making around listening to warnings. People who appear to be experts that aren't actually the credentialed experts. And that's been a problem before. That was a problem on the Y2K warning. If you all recall, remember on Y2K, we thought every computer was going to blow up because of some binary number issue. Turns out the person really making that warning wasn't qualified to make the warning. They had a PhD in some other science. There's a series of other things where if we don't listen to the actual correct body of science, then you kind of get flustered by degrees and credentialism and you get it wrong. My final point, sorry, were you going to say something?
No, I was agreeing.
And then my final point, you wanted to talk about the role of Facebook, et cetera. I'm a big First Amendment guy, right? So I don't like seeing anyone's commentary taken down from anything.
Yeah.
Even though I really believe that these doctors are doing a disservice and people might die because they listen to the wrong advice from them. And we have decision makers that are starved for people to confirm that their behaviors previously idiotic weren't so idiotic. And that's what you could see in the speech from these two doctors. Nonetheless, I don't like censoring of people's points of view. Now, that's not the same as a private company called Facebook or a private company called YouTube deciding what they put up or don't. They don't have by no means do they have the obligation to put up everything that someone throws at them. They don't. And to some extent, we know they have liabilities about certain things that are not protected speech going up there. So, for example, child pornography is not considered free speech, and YouTube not only has the right to take it down, they have the responsibility to take it down. So we accept that. This is protected speech. To go out there and say, I have an opinion about this disease, et cetera, that's protected speech. They have the right to go stand in the town square on a soapbox and yell about it all day. They have a right to write it and print it and mimeograph it and put it in your mailbox. YouTube, Facebook, the Nantucket Project, New York Times needn't be compelled to present that point of view. It's up to them. Now, what's happening is YouTube and Facebook, thankfully, is beginning to police their content, part one, and part two, maybe more importantly, police their algorithms. And this is a different conversation, but worth knowing. If you go to YouTube, for example, historically, and you type in terrorism or Al-Qaeda, you know, call it a semi-academic topic, it'll then show you videos of 9/11 because it knows historically the AI inside YouTube knows that's what people will like click on, clickbait. Oh, 9/11 videos. I can't stop watching the tower fall, right? So that happens. Then the next set of videos that it shows you, because it knows it's a hook in humans' mouths, is 9/11 denial videos. So YouTube actually promotes this shit because it knows that we buy it, we click it, right? And I've done it before. I've done that a lot. Obviously, I'm reading a lot about terrorism. It's one of my areas. And then I can't stop looking at the 9/11 videos. I've weaned myself off of that. But I have clicked on those, you know, 9/11 was inside job bullshit videos. But YouTube's algorithm used to push them because that's how they got more clicks. They're fixing that, or so they claim. They better. But does that mean that they should take those videos down? It's their call.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I'm with you on this largely. You know, if I had a hope, I wish there were like good housekeeping seal of approval type organizations that we came to trust. And at the minimum, we could sort of monitor, like, this is questionable, this is semi-verified, which is very difficult. This is very difficult. I think the position that they're in to sit in Mark Zuckerberg's seat and consider, you know, the question of the freedom of the press is way more complicated than people realize. Way more complicated.
I don't know. I don't think so, actually, on some issues. I think at some point maybe we'll have a conversation on anti-vax. But I would be comfortable saying, like, there's some things that R.P. Eddy, if I'm sitting in that seat, is 99.999% sure I'm right about that other people are wrong about. Flat Earth. No, right? Now, I don't know that there's a cost to having Flat Earth videos on YouTube, so I don't think I'd worry about the societal cost. So there's one where I know I'm right, I know they're wrong, but I don't see there's a cost to have it up on my platform. So not a problem. Anti-vax, I know I'm right. I know they're wrong. Huge societal challenge, off.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I hear that. I mean,
here's the thing. These authors aren't anti-vax, though. This is just an opinion by two people who don't have all the facts and are probably biased.
So let me just say that you may be right about that, right? And yet, I want to see both sides. Like, I've seen the documentary about the flat Earth. I want to see it. I want to know. Want to see what they say. And so
it's fun also because it's an interesting way to look at human behaviors.
Yeah. Well, and that's so that's where I fall on this question. And so I respect what you're saying. To you, it's a simpler matter. To me, it's a little bit more of a complex matter. And, you know, and for whatever reason, as a kid, we would do the debates, you know, abortion, not abortion, all these habeas corpus and all these things, the Miranda rights. And it just taught me over time that there are these principles that sort of undergird freedom and democracy. And, you know, sometimes the ACLU drives me crazy, but I respect that we have an ACLU. And Mark Zuckerberg drives me crazy, and I'm respectful of the fact that it's very difficult to navigate these things. And the difficult thing is that anti-vax to you, to somebody else, is, you know, the ultimate form of censorship. And that's just hard. And who makes that call?
It's when these things have a societal cost that it matters, right? And then you start getting into this nanny state question of, well, isn't every individual smart enough to make their own decision, look at the anti-vax stuff and this and that? And that becomes super hard.
Because it's hard.
To tell you the truth, my answer is no. In some instances, no. And that's so illiberal. But
right. Well, this is – and then that's – that again, that's why I say it's pretty tough stuff. Okay, but I think you're clear. I want to make sure you're clear. Would you argue that there are several inaccuracies
in
the statements these guys made? Yes. Yeah. Clearly. Yeah.
Okay. And I'm surprised, you know, I want to learn. I have a lot of respect for Elon Musk. It's very easy to sort of characterize him, make fun of him. He's the guy who smoked weed with Joe Rogan or whatever. But like Elon Musk has tended to be right on every opinion he's had so far that I can tell. And his success as an entrepreneur is so astounding. Having worked in Silicon Valley and having worked with people like this and worked with people who work with Elon Musk, like his success as an entrepreneur, holy Moses.
Amazing.
And the fact that he is now standing in the breach, wrong expression, the fact that he is now kind of siding with these, at least these two walk-in clinic doctors or whatever, is surprising to me. But then I guess he's probably aligned more with the argument we had, the conversation we had earlier about Sweden, right? Like, look, the long-term effect needs to be considered, isn't being considered. And he's probably running the math in his head and he comes out by saying, that's where we have to go. The conversation that would be interesting to have with him, if you could have it, would be, you know, Elon, not everybody has the wherewithal, the capacity or the assets you have to think, protect, and act like you can. So don't extrapolate your view of how you'd act to 330 million Americans and to presume the disease progression from that algebra versus the reality of 330 million Americans not being able to act as safely as you're going to be able to act.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, Tim Urban, you follow him at all? I don't know if you know Tim Urban, but sure. He would tell me these stories where Elon would be in these meetings with, you know, jet propulsion laboratory types, you know, the best Boeing engineers, best NASA engineers, and Elon would take these positions and he was like the one outlier, and time again, Elon would be right. And his brilliance is just incredible. It's incredible.
Yeah, and his work ethic. The other thing is also his work ethic is bonkers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So remember, let's be careful. I don't think that we can paint with one broad brush these two ER docs. Right now, what you could get, you could see a mush that goes like anti-vax, which to me is criminal. Corona denial, let's not worry about it, which to me is a little bit criminal. Not a lot of people are like that. Let's call that the White House for the first month. Like that was erroneous and wrong. And then you get this view of like, hey, I should put in the middle. Let's really, really get the math on both sides of the weight of the scale here, which is right. And that's probably where Elon is. And he's got a view on where that scale goes. And then you get, that's Sweden. Right? So Sweden, looking at Sweden and what they can do that we can't do, comes up with a decision that's different than ours. And it's probably, will probably be right, but hard to understand, right? Because you have a lot of lagging indicators, like it's going to take a couple years to do the math. And then the other end, you have, holy shit, lock everything down right now, must do only option. And that's wrong too.
Yeah.
And I don't think I would put the Elon Musk point of view over with the corona denial anti-vaxxer point of view. And if he is over there, then my opinion of him just dropped for the first time.
Yeah. And this would just be my prediction. It's not. And we haven't heard the full story yet. He can act immaturely at times. He does say some things that are more knee-jerk, and my guess is over time. I'm guessing here he will find a more accurate position. You know, the one other thing I wanted to be, just before we go, there are no new cases were reported in South Korea and Hong Kong, and in our home state, we've had good trends the last few days as well. Not like those, to be clear. That sounds like some good news.
Yeah. You know, well, Connecticut's had some really good news. We had the lowest transmissibility factor R naught in the country for a while. We may still. Greenwich has a slight increase of cases recently. But other countries, you know, are flattening the curve. But when you give the virus a chance, it'll bite you.
It's funny. So on this call, I got a text from a friend who has corona. I think everyone on this call knows the guy. I'm not going to say it because he didn't tell me I could share it. But you just mentioned our town, and he lives in our town. And he just was diagnosed. So,
how old is he?
Exactly my age.
Was he diagnosed as just seropositive, or is he sick?
He has no symptoms. His wife had it. His wife had it. Now he has it. But he feels fine. Totally fine.
And when did his wife recover?
I'm going to say about 2 weeks ago.
So it could be a very interesting example of an asymptomatic individual or one of these tests being wrong. But yeah. Probably the former, not the latter.
Yeah. Before we go, will I be taking a test before June, without, assuming I have no symptoms?
If you want to. Two of my business partners had tests yesterday and they're asymptomatic. They're available. I don't know why you'd spend the time or effort if you're asymptomatic, unless you can go back to January, February, February, March, and find a moment when you felt like you may have had the symptoms that we know are concomitant, you know, that dance with corona, or if you are exposed to somebody who you think may have had it.
Yeah. No, I don't really have a reason. I was sort of saying, will tests be widely available?
They are more and more available now. The challenge is that the Abbott tests are highly accurate. There's another test called like Euro something that's less accurate. Quest Pharmaceuticals has both of them. You can't really tell which test you get, apparently. Most likely you get the Euro test because it's faster and cheaper. The Abbott test takes time. So, you know, at some point, we're going to have some problems with the inaccuracy of a lot of these tests.
Yeah.
But those are improving. Accuracy is improving. Availability is improving. Where we need to get to, Tom, there's two things we need, right? One is we need to have enough tests available so that the kids, when they enter the Petri dish, we know if they're infected when they come out of the Petri dish, camp, school, et cetera. Same with people going into factories. And the other thing we need to understand is if having been infected confers immunity or not. We don't know yet.
Right.
It's a huge question. Just remember, you might go, well, of course it does. No, not of course it does. Did your cold from 3 years ago give you immunity from getting the cold last year? No. This is a coronavirus, also a cold virus. So.
Yeah. Okay, guys, we are, RP, thank you so much for being here as always.
It's such a pleasure, Tom. Thanks so much. I know I talked a lot today, but.
No, it was good. And we'll see you tomorrow.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
Bye.